Our scripture reading this morning comes from Luke chapter 5, verses 1 through 11. On one occasion, while the crowd was pressing in on him to hear the word of God, he was standing by the lake of Gennesaret, and he saw two boats by the lake, but the fishermen had gone out from them and were washing their nets. Getting into one of the boats, which was Simon's, he asked him to put out a little from the land, and he sat down and taught the people from the boat. And when he had finished speaking, he said to Simon, "Put out into the deep and let down your nets for a catch." And Simon answered, "Master, we toiled all night and took nothing, but at your word I will let down the nets." And when they had done this, they enclosed a large number of fish, and their nets were breaking. They signaled to their partners in the other boat to come and help them, and they came and they filled both the boats so that they began to sink. But when Simon Peter saw it, he fell down at Jesus' knees, saying, "Depart from me, for I am a sinful man, O Lord." For he and all who were with him were astonished at the catch of fish that they had taken. And so also were James and John, sons of Zebedee, who were partners with Simon. And Jesus said to Simon, "Do not be afraid. From now on you will be catching men." And when they had brought their boats to land, they left everything and followed him. This is the word of the Lord. Well, we're continuing our study in the book of Luke, and I was thinking this week, I have a personal theory about books. I believe that there are basically four types of books, at least in my life. The first, the base layer are internet books, or Google books, are books that I'm just interested enough to try and Google it, read Wikipedia, to maybe hear what someone else quotes it, but ultimately I'm not actually going to read that myself. I want just the top layer, or whatever on the back book jacket, to understand what's going on. The next layer for me is library books. These are books that I want to read once, but I don't really feel a need to own. For me, these are almost like the popular fiction books that I might read on vacation, like beach reading. Like I might read detective novels. The third level are bookshelf books. These are the books that I read and I hold on to, not necessarily because I like it, but because it impresses people when they see it on my bookshelf. This is how I feel about Ben-Hur or some of the obscure theological books that I've kept throughout the ages. The top layer, though, is forever books. These are books that I'm going to keep as long as I'm alive because they are so important and they are constant sources of encouragement and enlightenment for me. Knowing God by J.I. Packard is one of these forever books for me. I highly recommend it to everyone. And one thing that he does in this book is he talks a lot about the differences between knowing God and knowing things about God. Too often in the church, we settle for knowing about God. There are many brilliant scholars who I read and respect who don't know God personally, and there are people who know God very well, even if they can't explain the difference between free will and predestination. This is a challenge for all of us, but especially those of us here today, those of us who are in Reformed context in the Western world that stresses intellect and understanding. The challenge is, can we focus today not merely on learning more about God in our text, but on meeting him in the text? One of my mentors used to talk about some tools that are helpful for this. He called it the keychain for biblical interpretation. And these will help us to get into the text, not just to increase our comprehension and understanding, but also to meet God in the Bible. The first, so basically these are five rings that are always applicable to understanding the Bible. The first is the key of redemption, which is present in every story. The second is the nature of God, where we can learn more about who God is, even when he's not overtly present in the text, like in the book of Ruth. Third, the nature of man, which is always present. It runs parallel to the nature of God, always illustrating that contrast. Fourth is the character key, which is that everyone in the Bible is representative for us. And fifth is the example key, that from 1 Corinthians 10, that all these situations can show typologies and examples. Well, all five of those are at play in today's text. So I want to use these keys to look at this story, to put ourselves in the place of Peter, to learn more about the nature of God and our human nature by seeing Peter as an example of how Jesus offers us a path toward redemption. This morning, first, we'll look at Peter's situation. Then we'll look at Peter's immediate response. And finally, Peter's ultimate and eventual action. First is the situation. The situation in the Lake of Gennesaret, which is also the Sea of Galilee, is a great fishing story. There are several good fishing stories in the Bible. I'm sure many of us have important fishing stories in our lives. There's just something great about a good fishing story. One of my favorites came from my grandfather, who passed away this October. He grew up in a very small town in East Texas, and I'm not sure if you've spent any time in Texas or Oklahoma, but they fish a little differently down there, especially for catfish. One of the ways they do it is they go noodling, which is basically you search the riverbed for a hole where you're like, oh, I think that would be a good place for a catfish, and then you stick either your arm or your leg into that hole, hoping that the fish will bite down on your arm or leg, and then you have therefore caught the catfish. The other strategy is called grappling, which is you do when the water is pretty low, and then you just kind of walk barefoot down the river until you basically step on a catfish, at which point you reach down and put a grapple hook in the mouth, and you've now caught the catfish. It's a little bit different than fishing up here, even in Virginia. Well, my grandfather would always tell the story about how as a kid they went grappling when the river was low. They were trying to catch a big catfish for the 4th of July celebration for the town. And they caught one that was so big that he says it wouldn't fit in the bed of the pickup truck, that the tail was going up and over the tailgate. He said they cooked it and the whole town ate this one catfish. And now, another something that happens in a lot of fishing stories is a lot of fishing stories are not 100% accurate. That's a common aspect of fishing stories. And in fact, I think I'm the only one in my family who actually believed this story. But the reason I believed this story was that every time my grandfather would say that story, and someone would say, Earl, you know that's not true. And he would reach and pull out his wallet like he had a picture of the fish that he'd been keeping for 60 years. The picture was never in it, but he still reached for it the next time. See, the truth is, I love this story not because of the fish, but because of how it reminds me of the joy of interacting with my grandfather. Ultimately, what makes a fish story great is not really the fish, but the memory and the meaning. I believe that Peter's story, that the story that Luke is telling us here, is actually true, and that they caught all these fish. That's not a fib or exaggeration like maybe my grandfather's story. But I don't believe that the fish aspect is what makes this story great. It's what we're learning about Peter, about ourselves, and about Jesus. Leon Morris, one of the scholars that I've been reading through Luke, might have said it best when he said that the greatest catch that these fishermen had seen in all their lives was not as important as what it showed them about Jesus. So they followed him. See, Peter and the sons of Zebedee were professional fishermen, and this was the greatest catch of their lives. They were also experts, though. So before they went with Jesus, they had been fishing at the night, through the night, which was the most productive time. They just finished, and they had no luck. They were going back home. They were tired. They were dirty. They were probably ready for a hot meal and a warm bed. As they come back to the shore, they see Jesus teaching on the bank. And they're cleaning their nets to go home. Jesus asks to get into their boat and to put off a little from the shore so that he could keep teaching the crowd. I think this is a pretty big ask if you're Peter and James and John. You're tired. You want to go home. And Jesus steps in. Jesus goes out of his way to get into their boat, and just like he goes out of his way to get into our boat without waiting for us to be well-rested, well-fed, or prepared. You might not be fully dressed or have had time to vacuum your house when Jesus comes and asks you to push off from the shore, to push away from the comfort zones of your life. Then Jesus asked them to go deeper and to let down their nets even though as professional fishermen they should know more about fishing than Jesus does, and they know that they won't catch anything. Each of us have these aspects in our lives that we believe we have control over, things that we're good at, things that we're experts of. They might be our jobs, it might be our hobbies or our interests. It might even just be ourselves. We might think, well, at least we are experts on who we are. We know what we need. We know what we desire, what makes us tick. But Jesus knows more about us, knows better, and is asking us to step out in faith, just like he asked these men who knew more about fishing than most of the people, to step out in faith, to push out into the deep, and to let him prove his power by not relying on our ability and our knowledge, but on his authority. Jesus wants us to respond the same way that Peter did, which brings us to our second point this morning, Peter's immediate response. Peter responds by doing what Jesus asked, by pushing off from the shore, and by ultimately declaring in verse 8, "I am a sinner." See, Peter recognizes his own sinfulness, his own ineptitude, when he comes face to face with the power of God. This reminds me of how people say they feel small when they look at the Grand Canyon or when they look out at the ocean. It's why Neil Armstrong, when talking about his time in space, said, "It suddenly struck me that this tiny pea, pretty and blue, was the Earth. I put up my thumb and shut one eye, and my thumb blotted out the planet Earth. I didn't feel like a giant. I felt very, very small." Just like Neil Armstrong, Peter feels small because of the vast difference between him and Jesus. This idea happens throughout the Bible. Abraham feels it in Genesis 18. Job feels it in chapter 42. And it's very similar to when we first hear about the calling of Isaiah. In Isaiah 6, 1 through 5, we can read, "In the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord sitting upon a throne, high and lifted up, and the train of his robe filled the temple. Above him stood the seraphim. Each had six wings. With two he covered his face, and with two he covered his feet, and with two he flew. And one called to another and said, 'Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of his glory.' And the foundations of the threshold shook at the voice of him who called, and the house was filled with smoke. And I said, 'Woe is me, for I am lost, for I am a man of unclean lips, and I dwell in the midst of a people of unclean lips. For my eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts.'" Just like Peter and Isaiah, we should be amazed by Jesus and aware of the gulf of difference between him and us. We should feel this unworthiness and this sinfulness. Because when Peter here is calling himself a sinner, he's not talking about sin as we normally think of it. Daryl Bach explains that the sinfulness Peter is talking about is not a confession of individual transgressions, but a recognition of his character compared to the divine. So he's not talking about lying to his friends, lusting after his neighbor, or ignoring religious duties, but he's talking about the complete contrast between himself, Peter, and Jesus Christ, the Holy One in front of him. Peter recognizes that the one before him is fundamentally different than he and his friends are. That's why he uses the word master. It's only found in Luke that shows he's recognizing Jesus' authority to the point that he's giving Jesus the authority of his boat. If we could be like Peter at this moment, if we could have this response, there is good news for us. This understanding of our own status. If you're here this morning, if you aren't very religious, if you feel like you might be an outsider to the church, or if you are so caught up in pain or sin that you're not sure that you deserve to have this access to God, there is good news here. Joel Green explained that the sinful and the sick, whom Jesus seems really preoccupied with in the Gospel of Luke, is explained in our text because they share this label of outsider. They are the object of God's grace. And often these people in the Gospel respond to Jesus with openness, where the religious respond to Jesus with suspicion and hostility. If you don't feel like an outsider, there is still good news, because all of us, when compared to the holiness of Christ, should have the same realization of Peter, should know that we are found wanting. But despite this, no one is disqualified from following God. God does not reject the sinner, the sick, the young, the old, the men, the women, the handicapped, or the sick, but instead has plans to include them in his work. So finally, let's look at these plans and Peter's eventual action. We mentioned earlier that Peter did not ask, Peter did what Jesus asked him to do by letting Jesus onto the boat, by pushing off from shore, by going out into the deep and laying down his nets. We've also seen how that obedience brought results, that the fish that the men were able to catch. This is obedience that is the right response to the thumazo, the amazement that we've been talking about in the Gospel of Luke. Jesus tells the fishermen not to be afraid, because God's power should not make them withdraw from him, but to draw near and to commit themselves in obedience. Finally, Jesus tells the men that he will make them fishers of men, and that they drop everything they have to follow him. So God has this power to take ordinary and sinful people and to turn them into eternal servants in ministry. This is the higher calling that Jesus is inviting Peter, James, and John into, and it's also the calling that he's inviting us into. Daryl Bach explained that God is in the business of saving humanity, and some of us will get to help him in the catch. Peter and his friends were receptive, obedient, and committed. And how can we emulate this in our lives? How can we be like Peter and his friends as they responded to Jesus getting into their boat? I have two ways. First, we can be welcoming. So often in the church, we get caught up in this game of horizontal comparisons. We get upset because others might not be as involved as we are. They might not come to church every week. They might not give of their time or their talents. Maybe we have a moral problem with them. Maybe they cheat on their taxes, or they lie about their property line. And we ask, are they even Christians? We see this gap between them and us, and we think better of ourselves because of that difference. But here's the problem with that. The gap between you and the person that you're taking this private comfort and being better than is not really that big of a gap. There was a family that we grew up with in the same neighborhood as my family, and the mother of that family was really obsessed with the height of her children. She had three boys, and they were all pretty tall, and my brother and I were tall, and every time she would run into my mom, she would ask, how tall is Tim? And then she would tell how tall her son was. Like, it was this really important competition that went on for about 15 years, who was going to end up tallest. And I think he ended up beating me out by an inch or two, and I'm sure that she is still full of pride in her 6'7" son. But see, this is what we are doing in our lives, even if we don't see it the same way. We are arguing over inches. We're feeling that extra height brings us closer to Jesus. But from this text, and really from all of Scripture, we should see that it's not a matter of inches. It's not a matter of feet. There are miles and miles between us and the holiness of God. We are all terrible sinners compared to God. So why should we be so dismissive and so judgmental to those who might be slightly shorter than we are on a religious or moral scale? Instead, we must recognize our own smallness and then be able to welcome others who are in deep need of the same salvation that we are. We have much more in common with anyone who walks through these doors than we do with Jesus, the Prince of Peace, who brings all things, who created all things, who sustains all things, and offers salvation. This week, I want to challenge all of us to spend time with someone that we don't normally spend time with, someone in our congregation or somebody in your neighborhood, maybe somebody in your family that you haven't spent time with in a while. Spend time with this person and have in mind how God welcomes us into his presence regardless of our flaws and our failures, and try to practice the hospitality and grace of Christ and see the other person for a brother or sister in the same need as you. Second way we can apply this to our life, that we can be like Peter, is that we can be hopeful. See, despite these sins, despite our smallness, God cares about us immensely. It's not a matter of being perfect, but to follow the example of Peter in faith and humility. Peter recognized the chasm between himself and Jesus, and he responded with faith and obedience. Now, when Peter said he was a sinner, Jesus did not leave him there. He did not walk away, but instead, he took Peter and made him a part of the plan. So this humility allowed Jesus to transform a sinner like Peter, a sinner like me, a sinner like you, into a saint, bathed in the Spirit and prepared for ministry. One scholar wrote that Luke does not so much emphasize responsiveness to personal sin as stress that one should change one's mind about Jesus and thus become humbly obedient to him. Jesus can transform the sinner's life and vocation as the disciple comes to serve God. We must grow in humility and obedience to better serve God. This week, I'd like all of us to practice this in our prayer time. Instead of trying to find the perfect words or to highlight what we've done correctly, instead of trying to say what we think God would like to hear from us, let's approach God in humility. One way I like to do this is through a silent prayer or a listening prayer where you don't need to say anything at all. Just tune into God to listen to what he says. Listen to how he comforts you, how he challenges you, and how he changes you. We are all Peter. Jesus Christ has walked on to our boat. He has asked us to push away from our shores of comfort. He has asked you to put your trust in him, to go out into the deep water, to let down your nets. He has asked you not to be afraid. He has told you not to let your own sinfulness and inadequacy to keep you from the work he has prepared you for and is calling you to. He's asking you to be a fisher of men and women. He's asking you to drop everything you have and to follow him, to be a disciple. How will we respond this week?